for a book called We Were Pirates, A Torpedo Man's Pacific War. It's published by the Naval Institute Press. And today we have not only the authors of this book, but we also have the subject of the book. I will introduce them shortly, but let me first tell you a little bit about the Veterans History Project and how this event came to happen. The Veterans History Project was founded 10 years ago this fall. It was created by Congress, and we record and preserve and make available the narratives of veterans from World War I through the current conflicts. And to date, we've collected over 70,000 individual veterans' stories. Some of those stories are made available on our website, loc.gov/vets. About 10% of our collections are fully digitized, and every couple of months we do a feature on our website under the title Experiencing War, which we take a slice from the collection and we put it together and show you an aspect of veterans' history that you might know something about, maybe you didn't know anything about. And a couple of months ago, we decided to do one on submariners. I understand that that's also pronounced submariners, but for purposes of this discussion, I'll pronounce it submariners. This was an idea that was given to me a couple of years ago by a former colleague of mine, Peter Bartis, who now works in the American Folklife Center. And Peter was insistent that these were great stories that we should do one day on our website. And so when I finally got around to doing them, I realized I'd really missed the boat. They are great stories. But by waiting a little bit longer, we were fortunate to have one of the collections be that of Bob Hunt, who is here today and is the subject of this book. Bob served in World War II on a submarine, and I'm not going to go into the details of his service because he and his authors will very capably do that. But one thing I should note about Bob's service is that on VJ Day, which was August 15th, 1945, that is 65 years ago, coming up, the anniversary of that, Bob was in San Francisco and had a very, what I would call, interesting experience, which I think he might want to talk about today, or his authors might want to talk about that, just because it's very timely. And speaking of timely, the History Channel from cable and satellite television has been in touch with the library about getting stories from the Veterans History Project about VJ Day for their website. And in fact, starting tomorrow on the History Channel website, they will be featuring stories from the Veterans History Project about VJ Day, including Bob Hunt's story. So you can go to our website and look at the Submariners feature, or you can go to the History Channel website and look at Bob's story in another context there. Let me introduce you to the authors and Bob, and then I'm going to let them take over the program. They're going to each speak in turn, and after they finish speaking, there will be a brief question and answer period, and after that, they'll go outside the theater to the tables out front, and they'll be selling books out there, and you can buy a book and have all three of these gentlemen sign it for you. So, in order of appearance, speaking appearance today, first Robert Schultz, who's sitting in the middle of the three. He's the Fishwick Professor of English at Roanoke College in Virginia, and his books include a novel, The Madhouse Nudes, and two collections of poetry. He's received a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Award in Fiction, Cornell University's Corson Bishop Poetry Prize, and the Emily Clark Balch Prize for Poetry from the Virginia Quarterly Review. James Shell, who's sitting to my immediate left, has had fiction, nonfiction, and poetry published in the Roanoke Times, Jazz, College Poetry Review, Single Living, Ideas at Work, Artemis, Rock on Tour, Glenn Gould, and the University of Toronto Quarterly. He's a resident of Salem, Virginia, and We Were Pirates is his first published full-length work. And finally, last but certainly not least, Robert Hunt. Mr. Hunt was born in 1919 in Mason City, Iowa. In 1939, he enlisted in the United States Navy, in which he served until 1946. He's the retired director of Parks and Recreation in Decorah, Iowa, where he still lives and has lived since 1950. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Bob Schultz, who will start the program for us today. Bob.
Thank you very much, Tom. And thanks for the invitation to be here. When I was flying in with Bob yesterday, he told me that this was his first trip to Washington, D.C. And it's a wonderful event in recognition of Bob and his World War II service and kind of capstone experience to this whirlwind we've been on since the publication of this book. It's not a book that I ever planned to write. I'm not a military historian. I'm not by trade someone who writes historical nonfiction, but I did live two doors down from a rather kind and interesting gentleman in Decorah, Iowa, when I taught at Luther College. He taught our daughter to downhill ski when he was 75 years old. He was always riding his bike past with his tennis racket strapped to the back of his bike. And he regularly stopped to razz my wife as she was gardening or doing rock work and asking why this deadbeat author of a husband wasn't out there doing some of the physical work. So we knew Bob long before we knew his story. I published my first novel, and he sauntered down the sidewalk and said, "Well, so you're a writer. You never know who your neighbors are." And as it went along, I discovered it was even truer for me than for him, because he started telling me his stories of his war service and bringing down boxes and suitcases filled with photographs, his war diary, a battle flag. He was the unofficial archivist of the USS Tambor, and I got an eyeful. And I was writer enough to know when someone drops a treasure trove of primary materials in your lap, you got to write a book. So that's how this happened. Pretty soon, I accepted a position at Roanoke College. It happened in the middle of our process. James Schell took a couple of courses from me as a non-traditional student. I hired him as a research assistant. And when I found out what a good writer he was, we decided to write the book together. So this is how the book came about. I knew it had to be written because as I started to do research, I discovered, well, yes, Bob told me he had been on 12 consecutive war patrols on the USS Tambor. And as I did my research, I discovered, well, nobody did that. You were supposed to go on four and rotate off, take some time off. If someone else needed your rate on another boat, then you'd rotate on. It was unheard of. When I told people at the Naval Institute that he had done this, they looked at each other and said, "That's not possible. We haven't found anybody else who did this." And it gave us certain advantages because in writing about the Pacific War through Bob's perspective, we could follow the career of this submarine that was almost everywhere that mattered in World War II. It's just uncanny what Bob Hunt was in the middle of. For instance, the Tambor was stationed off Wake Island when the Japanese attacked the base there hours after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Standing topside watch, he saw the fires burning on the island. They signaled the defenders. Then they were hit by an aerial bomb, developed a leak in the forward room where Bob slept, limped back to Pearl Harbor so that they entered the harbor days after the attack. He was on the number one bow line at sea level, bumping through the oil and debris and smelling the stench and seeing the smoke. And as we interviewed him, we got a blow-by-blow account of what it was like to come in and view the devastation at Pearl just days after the attack. As a matter of fact, he was involved in the Battle of Midway, one of the few surface seamen who laid eyes on enemy ships. He was on lookout in the middle of the night, peering through binoculars when he spotted bumps on the horizon that proved to be a flotilla of four Japanese heavy cruisers. they had been told that there could be friendly ships in the area. They had to be very careful with their identification. They shadowed these boats all night. When they finally made a challenge signal near dawn, their presence threw this flotilla into such disarray that two of the heavy cruisers collided, shearing off 40 feet of the bow of one and staving in the side of the other. Later on, with the position given by the Tambor, dive bombers identified these two ships, sank one, and ravaged the other. So the Tambor basically did heavy damage to two cruisers without firing a shot. Bob also was on the boat when they made a secret trip to the Philippines to offload American guerrillas and supplies for the guerrillas there in the resistance against the Japanese occupiers. They cruised up and down the coast of China, Southeast Asia, the home islands of Japan, sinking freighters and tankers in submarine unrestricted warfare that basically choked off oil and rubber and other supplies and helped win the war. Every submariner or submariner has a depth charge story. In the East China Sea, after very successful attacks, the Tambor was sent to the bottom at about 280 feet by a Japanese destroyer that really had them pinned. They were submerged for a total of 17 hours, barely escaped with their lives. And afterwards, crew members decided to write accounts from their own perspective, compartment by compartment. These letters came to Bob's possession, and they came to me, allowing us to write, I think, maybe an unprecedented account of such a depth charge attack for two reasons. Most who suffered that severe a depth charging died in their subs, and no other crew that survived that I'm aware of made such a written record so that we were able to tell this story in 360 degrees. Let me just finish up by reading a couple of paragraphs about that encounter. The forward torpedo room was crowded. With a sub sitting on the sea floor, the main sound heads on the bottom of the boat were useless. So radioman Bill Shoup and Red Mayo were using the auxiliary sound gear in Bob's room. And since this was the only way to track the destroyer, except when its screws were audible through the hull, the captain was there too. This, in addition to the regular torpedo men and the reload crew, made for a full house. Bob, in charge of the room, tried to keep everyone occupied between attacks, instructing them to shut down leaks, mop up water, and sweep up debris. It was better than having everyone just standing around waiting for the next big jolt. Then a big blast came. It sheared a pair of bolts from the overhead and sent them ricocheting through the compartment like rifle bullets. One bolt, with its nut still attached, struck Bob Dye, but most of its energy was spent, and he was not badly hurt. Bob Hunt knew that the bolts held motors to the overhead, and if more of them were blown off, the heavy machines would crash down. He told the men in the bunks under them to move so they wouldn't get hurt when the motors fell. This did scare the hell out of them, he wrote in his diary, but it got them moving rather than lying in a bunk and getting smashed by a motor. As the attack wore on, Captain Kefauver made his way from room to room, assessing the Tambor's condition. As he went, he made a point of speaking with every man, and as he departed, each compartment, he said the same thing over and over. I am honored to have served with you. If it sounded like the captain was preparing for the worst, it only made plain what everyone was thinking. Nevertheless, the crew kept working, and gradually the air leaks were brought under control. One daring effort was made by the machinists Gus Builder and William Wood, who crawled across the top of the sub's powerful batteries on rubber blanket to get into the pressure hull and tighten fittings inside the number one air bank. Little time passes. They suffer more near direct hits, including two that struck the deck, rolled off, bounced off the side, and proved to be duds. This was a lucky day. It was now past noon, and the Tambor had been under depth charge attack for 8 hours. Now, in a pause between blasts, Captain Kefauver turned to his chief torpedoman, looked him in the eyes, and asked, Bob, did you ever hear depth charges this close before? Not that close, Captain, Bob replied. Then Kefauver said, we've got to get out of here. Well, they were stuck in the mud. When they blew the tanks, all the depth charges had settled them into the sand. It took a couple of hours to rock the thing out of there, losing power and air all the time. When they finally got to the top in the dark, they had basically a disabled boat, And the story of the repairs is as interesting, as heroic, as the survival of the depth charges. So this is just a small taste of the kind of stories that we learned as we talked to Bob and his crewmates and looked at his materials. I think basically the Naval Institute Press was interested in this book for three reasons. It's a story of an enlisted seaman, and those stories are more rare than the stories told by officers. It's also the story of the Tambor, which is the first of the fleet class, first fleet class of World War II subs, so it's a significant boat. And third, they were intrigued by the stories that Bob had to tell, very candid stories, about how these submariners took care of themselves when they were on liberty between patrols. And I'm going to turn that subject over to James.
Well, first of all, I like to second Bob's comments about the fact that I never anticipated writing a book like this or on this subject until it kind of dropped in my lap. As a matter of fact, before I started work on this, the most recent pieces that I've written were on classical music, so you can see that there is quite a contrast between the two subjects. And all I knew pretty much about submarines was what I'd seen in a few old movies. So I had to take a crash course, no pun intended, on this whole subject. One of my proudest moments was I was working on a section that occurs early in the book, which basically describes the type of fleet submarine that Bob Hunt served on from one end to the other, all the compartments and what you found in them, the what purposes they served, and how a submarine of that type operates. It was one of my proudest moments when, after Bob Hunt read this section, he had a submarine qualifying certificate made up for me and sent it to me from his home in Iowa. That told me that I must have gotten it right. I've become so obsessed with getting every little detail right that I kept emailing him, and he wrote me at one point, "You sure do ask a lot of questions, don't you?" But, I really wanted to get it right, and I hope that I did. But getting back to what Bob Schultz was saying about the way this book portrays life both on and off the boat for the submarine sailor, this is something that we didn't feel that most previous books and movies about the subject really covered. And Bob Hunt always gave us kind of the guiding credo of the book was to tell it the way it was and don't leave anything out. So that's what we tried to do. And we were lucky in this respect that he was very frank and honest about all of this and allowed us to be equally frank and honest in the retelling. And when I speak now to people who have read the book, one of the most frequent comments I hear is not about all of the exciting battles like Bob Schultz just described to you, but they say something like, "Boy, those guys sure had a wild time when they weren't out at sea, didn't they?" Which is true, but you have to realize a couple of things. One is that these were very young men. Bob Hunt was 22 years old when the attack on Pearl Harbor occurred, and they called him Old Timer because he was one of the oldest people on the boat. Most of the rest of them were teenagers. Also, they never knew if their next war patrol would be their last. They never knew at any time when they went out to sea that whether or not they were going to come back. Bob Hunt actually had told us on more than one occasion that he didn't really expect to come back. He didn't really expect to get out of the war alive. So as a result of this, when the submarine sailors did have some free time, as we phrased it in the book, they popped ashore like corks out of champagne bottles.
That's your line.
And when the sub-sailors were stationed for most of the war either in Pearl Harbor or in Western Australia, and the U.S. Navy had made sure that they had the use of some of the finest luxury hotels in each area to rest and recuperate. And Hawaii. They have the run of the Royal Hawaiian, which is a famous old pink hotel that's there you may have heard of. When they were in Australia, there were two luxury beachfront hotels, the King Edward and the Ocean Beach, that were reserved for their use. So the Navy appreciated the fact that when these guys weren't out at sea, that they needed somewhere to unwind. And this is not to say that they always approved of the methods that they used to unwind. For example, one of the necessities that the subsailors considered on Liberty that they absolutely needed was an ample supply of drinkable alcohol. And it was not always easy to fill this need by conventional means because there was an acute shortage of alcohol in Western Australia when they were there. And while there was no shortage in Pearl Harbor during the war, the price of whiskey was sky high, sometimes reaching as high as $40 a bottle. So they needed an alternate supply source. And the first place they looked was something that was called Pink Lady, which is alcohol-based torpedo fuel, which they had on the submarines in 55-gallon drums. Now, the problem with this was it was laced with a pink oil, which gave it its name, which also made it undrinkable. All of their efforts to make it drinkable went nowhere until Bob Hunt one day met a fellow sailor whose name is lost to history, but in the book we chose to call him the supplier because he seemed to have an uncanny ability to supply any commodity from which he could make a profit at any time. The supplier actually had a still that converted the Pink Lady to drinkable alcohol, and he and Bob made a deal that for every 5 gallons of Pink Lady Bob provided him, the supplier would give him back a pint of drinkable alcohol. And their partnership went well until the night the supplier took Bob to the married sub-sailor's housing development looking for women whose husbands were away on war patrol to spend some time with. Bob ended his partnership with the supplier after that, but he was able to procure the plans for the still, so they were able to build one of their own. The experience also inspired Bob to renew his pledge not to get married until after the war ended, which he kept. Bob did not lack for female companionship during the war, however. If you would call him the sailor with a girl in every port, you would be selling him short, actually. I'll recount just one of his more interesting experiences with women that exposed him to more danger than he ultimately faced, sometimes hunting down Japanese freighters in the middle of the Pacific. There are many such examples in the book. I'll give you just one. This was when he was in Western Australia, and he was walking down the street of a small town named Katanning, where the sub-sailors like to spend their time off, and he saw a girl riding a horse down Main Street and stopped to talk to her. It turned out her name was Greta, and her family was German, and as Germans, they were automatically figures of suspicion in Australia. They were required to meet with local authorities at regular intervals to explain their activities and assure everyone that they were not Nazi spies. At the ranch where she lived, Bob met Greta's parents, shared a meal with the family, and saw their part of the countryside. He must have made a fair impression, he thought, because the visit resulted in a second invitation, this time to a neighbor's ranch. At that outing a few days later, Bob and some shipmates went rabbit hunting with the ranch's owner. Then, just before dinner time, the rancher led Bob to a corral that held some very nice-looking quarter horses and asked him if he'd like to ride one. Perhaps he thought all Americans were born cowboys, but for Bob it had been a long time since he'd sat on a horse. But Greta was looking on expectantly, and Bob had been a good rider as a boy, so he picked a brown and white pinto, and the ranch hand saddled it up. Perhaps he did not choose wisely. The rancher had said something about the horse not having been ridden for a while, and apparently there was a reason. For the moment Bob climbed aboard, the pinto bolted out of the corral and flattened into a full gallop. Bob had barely gotten his hands on the reins and his feet into the stirrups, and now he hung on for dear life. Out of memory or instinct, he bent low over the horse's neck, but this made him feel only slightly more secure. Pulling back on the reins and shouting "Whoa!" had no effect on the charging animal. It ran like its tail was on fire. Bob thought of saving himself by jumping off, but the view rushing past, shaking and jolting with the clatter of hoofbeats, was of potholes and stones. Eventually, this animal has got to tire out, he thought desperately, but I may not be on it by then. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see a shipmate standing on the rails of the corral, whooping and laughing. Maybe, he thought, I can steer him back to the corral. Bob pulled the reins to the left as hard as he could, and the horse's path bent into a wide leftward trajectory. He had to hang on like death, and his arms were tiring, and still the stony ground rushed past in a blur. Finally, after swinging in a wide arc, the Pinto was headed back toward the corral, still at a full gallop. But it missed the gate and was pointing instead at the ranch house, where a clutch of family and guests watched the spectacle from the front porch. As the house rushed toward him, Bob tried everything he knew but could neither slow the horse nor turn it to the right or left. As the house loomed up, Bob saw the folks on the porch startle and begin to scatter. They were galloping straight for the front porch, and he knew they were going to hit it. The horse stiffened all four legs and dropped its rump, skidding now towards the porch steps in a sudden cloud of dust. The horse hit the steps and suddenly disappeared from under Bob, who flew through the air. Bob skipped once on the porch floor and slammed into the front of the house. He lay still on his back. In the sudden quiet, he was afraid that if he tried to move, he would discover that he couldn't. Then he heard the others running to him, shouting his name, and he moved his arms and legs. When he sat up, he realized to his surprise that he was not badly hurt, just bruised, scraped, and shaken. Even more miraculously, the Pinto was already back on its feet, panting and snorting, but also unharmed. And once it became apparent to everyone that Bob and the horse had survived, everyone clapped him on the back and laughed. Then the dinner bell clanged, and everyone left Bob to go inside and eat. He turned to follow, still vibrating like a struck gong. He wasn't the least bit hungry. What he really wanted was a stiff drink. I think the last word on Bob's off-the-boat experiences, as well as an indication of the luck he seemed to enjoy while he was on the boat, may well be the fact that the only injury he suffered during his time as a submarine sailor was when he lacerated his finger while trying to open a beer bottle in Western Australia.
Scar. They didn't give me a medal for that one.
No Purple Heart.
No, I didn't get one. Shoot, but I rightly cut my finger off.
Well, we're going to hear from Bob now, and I thought I would ask him a few questions and get his responses. But, Bob, you want a chance to get it back at us here at all about what we're talking about?
What else is there? You've done it all.
You told us to tell it the way it was.
Tell it what the heck it was, and you did. What a beautiful, what a couple of guys to have on your team, huh?
Well, since there was mention of VJ Day and Bob's experience in San Francisco, why don't we get into that a little bit? After Bob left the boat, after his 12th patrol, the Tambor went on one last patrol, the 13th, but Bob wound up in San Francisco, and he was invited to found and run a torpedo tube school at Hunter's Point, and that's what you were doing at the end of the war, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, right. And you were ran the school right up until I got out of service.
And tell us about the little ritual that you had when the sub went off and what was said on the sub and by the folks who were throwing off the lines. That'll give us some background for that San Francisco story.
I understand.
Tell them about that ritual.
Yeah, I don't know. About that far from the mic, is that all right? I'm not used to this kind of stuff, so we'll just give it a shot here. What was your question?
What did you guys say to each other when the sub went off on patrol?
Well, you see, when you came in, a patrol, I just try to make this as simple as possible here. You went on war patrols, and you went out for 2 months, and you were all alone and on your own, your boat, and so forth and so forth. And we're in enemy waters all the time. Yeah, give me a little more water. So, so anyway, I'll take a little drink of this. So So what was our question here? What
are we, your send-off back and
forth.
Oh,
yeah. So, all right. So every time we went on a war patrol, nobody was so secret that nobody knew that you were supposed to know that you were going on a war patrol. But our girlfriends always knew, and somehow they knew when we were coming back, too. And I don't know how they ever figured that out, but they knew we'd be gone about 2 months. So, so anyway, let me get back now. Let me just settle down. Okay, what did we say back and forth? All right. So naturally, we had to transfer about a fourth of the crew every time we came into port because of the rotation, because you weren't supposed to make more than 4 war patrols with it. And I already had about 9 in or 8 in or something about that during those times. So I knew I was gonna go out on the boat, but who was standing along the line when we threw off the line? And I was always on number one line, so I had to throw off the last line that was thrown off was my line that I was in charge of, the number one line. And so just as soon as we got ready to pull her away from the dock, then we'd all holler over to our buddies who didn't got off the boat and were not going on that war patrol with us. But, you know, they're going to be there to tell us good luck, goodbye, and give them hell or something, you know. And they're all standing along the dock, and they say, and they holler up and says, hey, they holler to us on the boat. Anyway, they holler, and we'd holler back. They'd holler at us, good luck and good hunting and all that, And what would we say back to them? Then we'd say to them, they'd say good luck and good hunting. I forgot the story. Anyway.
Well, what about Market Street?
Oh, yeah, there you are. That's it. See, he remembers. All right. Okay.
He taught me everything I know.
Yeah, right. He says that. We were on the boat, see, and, well, of course, we were all in very bad shape because we knew we were going to sea that day, and we'd been spent all night, and we hadn't been to bed or anything, and we'd been drinking all night, and now we're trying to. So we'd holler back at those guys, and they'd say, good luck, good hunting, and we'd yell back at them, and they said, okay, fine, that's okay, but wave the flag on Market Street for us if we don't come back. And so that was our last word that we would say as we left. And we'd tell them to take care of everything till we got back. So,
yeah. And that's the background for Bob's experience on VJ Day when he was traveling in a car with a couple of buddies and they heard on the radio that the Japanese had surrendered. And so you were down on Market Street.
We were coming in from Hunter's Point, where I was had the school.
Yeah,
and we had carpools like you have, and there were 4 of us that were all sub sailors that had made war patrols, and we're halfway into town.
So you
go ahead for then, and that's when they came on a radio. We had the radio on,
and you saw some of the first reactions down on Market Street.
Well, that was afterwards, but the first thing we heard was on the radio,
right?
And they're all of us in the car, and it says that they had dropped the bomb. They had dropped the bomb on Japan, and that the war was over. And so we knew that the war was over, and we were in the car halfway into town. And then when we hit the town, the main street of San Francisco, Market Street, John, thank you, and Market Street in San Francisco, and we hit the main street, and you never saw. You've seen the pictures in New York City, and the nurse getting kissed on the thing, and everybody knows that picture. Well, they were climbing the flag, the light poles. Everybody was hollering and yelling and having fun, and as we drove on into town, and they started throwing stuff out of the windows, and you know that. You've seen pictures of that. All the offices up in these big in the main buildings would throw the stuff out, and everybody was kissing everybody else, and running around and all that good stuff, And so I'm losing my.
So you saw the celebration.
Oh yeah, the celebration. Oh yeah,
and then you remembered. Right, so, you remembered the send off.
That's right. That goes back to see. Then now we entered the celebration, and I remembered that they had told me to wave the flag on Market Street. See, now I, of course I hadn't forgotten that. But what happened is they let me off at where I lived. I lived in San Francisco downtown. I had an apartment. And so they let me off on Market Street, and I took the cable car up to my corner, and then I went to my apartment. But here I am now at my apartment. The war is over. The big celebration is going on down on Market Street. But I don't have my flag, and I wasn't really, didn't even have my uniform on. I took my cap and I put that on, and I'm by golly, I'm going to go down and march for my guys on Market Street and wave the flag. But I didn't have a flag. I said, by God, I'm going down there anyway. I'm gonna. So I put on my uniform. I wasn't even in uniform. I put on my uniform and my cap and the whole thing. I didn't put a tie on, but I just put the cap and the uniform, and I went heading for down to Market Street because I had a march on Market Street, but I had to wave the flag. But I was going to march anyway, but I didn't have a flag. And I got about two blocks down the pike, and here's a little boy playing in the gutter. And that little kid had a flag. And oh, yeah, thank you. And that he had a flag, and it was just about that big. And that little kid is waving that flag, and I looked down at that kid, and I said, hey, kid, I want to buy your flag. He said, no way. And you've seen the one on television where the big guy is coming out, and the big football player, and he's talking to the little kid. I don't remember what that, but that's the same kind of a jargon, you know. So the little kid is arguing with me. He says, no way, old man. He says, I'm not giving you my flag. And I says, what if I give you $20? Huh? I said, here's $20. Give me the flag, kid. And he says, here, get a flag. So, boy, I got my flag. And you can imagine after I went to all the trouble and thinking about my guys that had all mostly died going on war patrol. So, and here I am, and I not only got, I'm halfway to Market Street, and I got a flag. And so I got down, and I got back. I had to get on the cable car to go back down. It was about six blocks down. I was down the hill from where I lived right there. And so I got the cable car down there, and there was, I see a big commotion up above, up there. And they were wheeling the, got to use my hands. Anyway, so things had changed since I left Market Street and I had to get home, and I came back down and I heard all this noise and saw smoke and heard sirens and all this kind of stuff. And I said, what in the world's going on? I just left here. And everybody was happy as clams, see? And so here I am. And as I got, I only had a little ways to go to be right on Market Street, the middle of the street. And I looked up and my God, there was smoke. There was a police car turned upside down. It was set on fire, and they had busted the big windows out of all the department stores all the way down Market Street, and they had pulled the mannequins out and threw them in piles in the middle of the street. I'm talking about downtown San Francisco, and the rioters had lit off fires. There was one police car turned over on its side. The fire department, they had blocked them. The fire truck tried to get in the area, and they had blocked it with mannequins and piling stuff in the street. And what had happened is that they also had broken into the liquor stores and knocked the windows out, so they had plenty of booze, and it just kept going, firing up. And as I was trying to walk, see, I didn't have far to walk, but I wasn't getting very far because of all this rioting going on. And all of a sudden, some guy knocked me down. And they started grabbing at my cap. They wanted to take my cap, and they were kicking at me. And it was riot time. And I had only gotten about a block and a half And boy, did I turn around, and I just put my head down, and I played a lot of football, and I got myself back on the cable car, back to the cable car, and I got myself back up to my corner. I had four bars on the corner, one on each corner, and the bar was right there, so that I just very quickly got in the bar, got a shot of whiskey and a bottle of beer and another shot of whiskey, and I just sat there. And I slugged about three or four of those, and I went home.
So this was Robert Hunt's reward at the end of a distinguished war career, attempting to honor his comrades by waving the flag on Market Street. As I understand it, you did fight him off, and you did retain your chief's cap.
Yeah, they tried to take all my cap. They wanted that real bad.
But somehow in the melee, you lost that little flag.
Yeah, I never. Yeah, that. Thank you, because I hadn't even thought of that. Yeah, the flag was gone right away, because I couldn't handle all this stuff. But you know, I'm a fighter, and I mean, I'm going to take them out. I don't care if it's 20 of them. You know, I'd go at them. I did that in Australia one time. I took on 20 Aussies on the street, and the trouble was with that story was that our hotel that the sub sailors were staying in was within earshot of there, and they heard the commotion down there. And boy, when the sub sailors started pulling out of there, and those 20 Aussie guys that were trying to beat me up, sure got out of there in a hurry. And this is, you know, just part of the story. This is the way the thing was going.
Well, let's see if you all have questions for any of the three of us, particularly for Bob, and see if we can respond to them.
What's the significance of the title, We Were Pirates?
Yeah,
I heard that. That's a good one. I think it was James that sent me a letter one time, and he said that he had gotten a letter from somebody, and the guy said that when the sub sailors came in to report, they wouldn't have anything to do with he said we was tough. And this is an old sub sailor, an old chief that he had told, was telling me about. And he said, we didn't pay any attention to anybody else when we came in. We were with our own people, and we didn't bother anybody, and they didn't bother us. He said, actually, he says we were like pirates. He said when we went out there, we were like pirates, and that was our job to take prisoners and sink boats and fishing boats and stuff like that and get information and all that. So we were really pirates, and that's where from that letter from him. And I said, well, of course we were. Now, what a name for the book. We were pirates, because it's the truth. That's what we did.
And it came from two directions. That's one of them. And then I remember a conversation I had with Bob. He showed me the battle flag that the signalman made on board out of linens and deck paint. With an eagle holding a torpedo in one hand and a Japanese ship in the other, and rising sun symbols around the edge for the various sinkings. And I was curious. I asked Bob, well, when you were on patrol, did you fly the stars and bars, or did you fly, you know, the battle flag, or both? And he said, well, heck, when we were on patrol, we didn't fly a flag. We were pirates.
Yeah, that's right. We never showed any colors. You look in all the pictures of a submarine or boat on war patrol. If you saw anything, you'd probably see some woman's underwear flying from the number one periscope. Because we got the women's underwear, because we got rag bags to clean up the grease all the time when we were singing. They'd send us a bundle of rags, you know, to use for cleaning. And every once in a while, you'd find the women's underwear in the thing, and boy, nobody parted with that. And so what we did on our boat, we're coming into port from a war patrol, and they had the battle flag already up there and stuff like that. One of the lookouts had some of these and stuck in his pockets. He climbs up and he hangs them right along with the other flag in the camera. You're madder than hell.
Yes.
When you landed supplies in the Philippines, what did you take back?
All right. You really opened a big story, but I'll shorten it up as much as I can here. And it's a terrific story. We were one of the first boats that was chosen because MacArthur was having trouble getting anybody to fight the guerrillas. But he did be able, they were able to organize guerrillas, people, guerrillas that were fighting against the Japanese. They didn't like the Japanese either, the Filipinos. And so they were fighting. You know, I'm having a hard time keeping straight here because what was the question?
Well, talk about taking Chick Parsons to...
No, yeah, right. So our mission was, we had a mission was to take Chick Parsons, who was the guy that ran the whole thing there.
Sort of the, he was working for MacArthur and helping MacArthur organize,
I was trying to
organize
think of,
the...
Yeah. MacArthur,
the resistance.
Yeah. MacArthur, Chick Parsons was MacArthur's buddy, and he helped MacArthur with a lot of things, and so Chick came back to the United States. He was you know Filipino and in the Philippine Islands, and he was big out in the Philippines. Anyway, he got back to the United States, and he said, "Boy, if we can arm those guerrillas with." Any kind of guns and ammunition and dynamite and stuff like that. Why? And so the boats, they started sending the boats in, but we were the first ones to go in. And I not only was on the boat that took Chick Parsons back from the United States after MacArthur had organized to start sending the boats in there with ammunition and stuff to fight the Japanese. So anyway. So
we found it amusing that Chick Parsons was so shocked at the heat inside the submarine, which he found intolerable. The guys worked in skivvies, sweating into their shoes. The timbre air conditioning broke down almost every mission. On this one, it worked all the way through, and so the crew thought they were having a pretty good time of it, but Chick Parsons was finding it intolerable. So the bilges that he slept in?
He got mad and so at the conditions, he was I didn't like him, see, and so I got stuck with him because I was in charge of the port room. I said, "Here, who the hell does he think he's in coming here and tell us what to do here?" But anyway, he was smart, but you know, one of those guys, and they thought he was a big wheel and sort of. But he was in my department, so he had to do what I told him. So it was always so hot, and so he finally found out that the crew used to crawl in the bilges. It was cooler down there, and if you didn't have a map full of water, boy, you were all right. And so anyway, so he's down there, and I'll tell him about that story about what happened to him. How he could have had a Purple Heart because. He got injured on our boat, and so Parsons is down there, and boy, I didn't like him, and so he was giving orders, all right, like he was running something, but it was my compartment. I didn't care what he had to say. So old Chick is he's complaining and bombing around, and so I got to have a fan. He says, "Get me a fan," and my guys were saying, they said, "What are we doing?" I said, "Why don't you go back in the engineering department? They probably got a fan because you had to have fans to use." So they went and got an old Chick a fan. So they put an extension cord and put old Chick down in the bilges. The bilges are underneath. That's where the extra water drains. You could pump them out, you know. But it was cooler down there. And old Chick, he's down there. And my bunk was right back of that. And if you look at the pictures of... Where, like, if you're right in the forward room, my bunk was right up there, right at the end of the tubes, and I'm sleeping away, and all of a sudden I heard this yell, and he come flying out of those bilges, and he said, holding his hand up, and the blood is running down his arm, and I said, "What the hell's the matter with you?" And he says, "Hey, finger!" He stuck his finger in the fan. I was laughing. I said, "Oh, come on, get out of there. Come on, go back. The guy will patch you up." And so that's how I got back at I got back at Chick Parson. He got injured. He got injured. I didn't like him anyway, but so we unloaded him. we unloaded him, but we were the first boat. We were the first boat to take supplies into the Philippines. And then after we took Chick Parsons in, who we left there to organize the guerrillas in the whole Philippine Islands. He was in charge of the whole thing. And so we left him there. And from then on, we had a series of boats that were delivering and taking out, you get out of there. We were taking out people, nurses and things like that that needed to get back out of the area. And so we'd haul in the ammunition, and then the boats. We had a continuous stream of boats coming in on schedule that would land at the different ports along in the Philippines, and then we would unload the ammunition and supplies, and then we'd also take out people that needed to get important people, VIPs, to get them out of there back to the United States, because we would take them back home then so they could go home.
I think we're going to allow a little time for more Q&A during the book signing. So we're going to repair to the outside for book signing, but before we do, I want to present each of you gentlemen the Certificate of Appreciation from the Veterans History Project.
Thank you very much. Oh, look out.
And let's give all of them a big round of applause.